And you probably got tired of doing that. And then the last question was if you'd write a little program that would do the conversion for you. And so this is my three-line version of it, which is sort of a bit of arcane Fortran. So the only thing that is really interesting here is that there's this equivalence statement. And that means that you can actually, in Fortran, do something that's incredibly dangerous. You can assign the same or two different names corresponding to two different things, in this case, an integer and a real, to the same location in memory, right? And you might want to think, well, why would I do that? Well, so for instance, one practical purpose of this was that I could have a part of memory which would be a matrix, and I wanted to address it as a linear array and as a two-dimensional array at the same time. And then you can do these things. Then all I just do is that this is mumbo-jumbo for a hexadecimal constant. And I just set my integer equal to that, and then I write it out as a real. And it tells me the real number that corresponds to that, right? So you can, and then, of course, if I want to do it the other way around, then the screen goes black. So probably not entirely unjustified. So I can, I just set the real equal to whatever real one number I want, and then I write out the integer. And I write out the integer, so, well, it's some other Fortran lingo that you can have fun looking at, and that's format statements for how you want your output formatted. Basically, hexadecimal constants are preceded with a capital set. So I can write it out, you know, these are the two lines that we need, and it prints it out as a hexadecimal constant. There are loads of fun little things that you can do in Fortran. The reason why you may actually want to try to do this is that I wrote this little program because at some point when I looked at this exercise, I actually started to question whether the Intel compiler used completely the IEEE standard that I told you about yesterday. And it would sort of be a pity that if somebody looked at the computer and told me, well, you know, if I do it on the computer, then I, you know, it's not what you're telling me. I was lucky enough that the Intel Fortran compiler actually does and gives you the result that corresponds completely to the model that we I described yesterday in the course. But don't be surprised if you dig up. So I didn't check this on systems that were built on top of an AMD Opteron. So don't be surprised if you come by some fancy hardware, then maybe this is not going to work precisely. But it shouldn't detract from the fact that the underlying models are always roughly the same, right? You wanted to have a closer look at the, so I think we can, remove this. If you, feel the desire, then, we're going to put a link on the wiki for sort of a couple of papers that, or at least one paper that I found, which gives you all the gory details about these floating point representations, probably more than you would ever like to know. Also a link to the actual Intel Fortran compiler, which is the one that you have available on Proteus. So at some point, you may want to have a look at this. Yes.
The statement where you wrote I is equal to Z.
Yes.
Is there a space required?
I don't think so. I mean, there shouldn't be a space.
I unfortunately don't have a file on my laptop, but the program I compiled on my main Intel box. Okay, so what I just want to tell you a few things here about Randolph errors. So imagine now that we have a number x here, and then we want to put this on the computer and then represent it somehow. Then what I ended up talking about yesterday was the fact that the numbers we can actually represent, they will form these discrete points. And of course, they're not going to be equally spaced. So suppose the point you want to represent is here. Then the two numbers that we have available here, that might be x plus and x minus, which would be the nearest one below it and the nearest one above it. So if x here, if we write it, so it's some normalized form here. So it's b1, and then we reach our b23. But then, unfortunately, things continue here. So that would be our binary code. And then we maybe will need some power to 2 here. Then I can get x minus here simply by chopping. So x minus here, that would just be taking the bit pattern here and then throwing out whatever is remaining there, right? And correspondingly, x plus here, that's just going to be, well, what would be the nearest number that you could have here? It would be x minus. But then the smallest thing I can add to it would be 2 to the minus 23. But then I should remember the exponent here, right? So that's going to give me that over here. So to obviously now we can develop this and look at a lot of interesting, basically numerical analysis. What we're going to say here is that when we represent the number on the computer, then I'm going to call it either FL of x, or sometimes I'll just call it xc, where the little c means that that is the number that x got converted to when it ended up on the computer. So that number will be the x we desire, and then multiplied by 1 plus delta, where delta here, that sort of gives you the relative error for when you did this conversion. And you can probably see here that I can easily try to figure out if x ends up here, then in this case, that would be a good estimate here of where to get delta. But what we're going to say here is that delta, for all practical purposes, we can get an upper bound on it by saying that it's going to be limited by what we call machine epsilon yesterday, right? So what's going to happen is that you'll pull out an algorithm for a library for doing whatever you want to do, and it's going to ask you, and sometimes particularly, what is the machine epsilon that you have available on the computer. And I hope if you looked at the tutorial yesterday, then you saw that you can actually go in and you can just ask Fortran, well, what is the machine epsilon? So if I had a reel here that maybe I defined, I selected the kind that I wanted, and then I call it X. Then I can actually go in, and then I can ask for epsilon of X. It's just going to give me this number here. So there's sort of not any excuse for not thinking about these issues when you program in Fortran. So why would we be concerned about these round-off errors? That's because, of course, as we do calculations and multiply numbers together, then they start to compound. And people look at this for a living. So I'm just going to tell you a few crucial things about this that is very important when you want to write a program. So the first thing you want to look at is subtractive errors. Right. So maybe you want to do something really complicated, like calculating B minus C. Right? We hope you can all see that that might be useful. Then when you do this on the computer, you can't really do this because what you'll end up doing is choosing a representation for C and the same thing for B and then subtracting these two numbers. Now, if I follow what I did over here, then we would say that, B here, that should be 1 plus delta B. And then C here, it should be 1 plus delta C, where, of course, delta here can both be positive and negative. So if I want to look at the relative error here, so look here at AC over A here, well, then this is going to be B minus C over A, which is precisely, of course, what I want here. And then I get B over A times delta B, and then minus C over A times delta C. So we can look at this then what we'll just see here, if we assume that B here is close to C, we can see here that AC over A, well, what does it become equal to? Well, I just get 1 here. And then I get plus something that would be B over A here, and then delta B minus delta C. Of course, we don't know if what the sign of these deltas are, but you can probably see that if B here is close to C, and then that would mean that the real A that we're looking for could be a very small number. This is, of course, going to go to infinity as B goes to C. So in other words, it's a horrible idea to subtract two large numbers to get a very small number. Right? You can allow yourself to do this if you are looking at playing around with integers. But if you do this with floating point, it's sort of a typical error that you write a program, it's working wonderfully, and then in a real life application, then unfortunately you're going to be close to a case where you have sort of catastrophic cancellations that are occurring, and you will just get results out that are nonsensical. So I'll give you a few examples that we all know and love. But before doing that, I just want to tell you about the other The other thing that we, of course, can do, and that's just to multiply numbers together. So I take two of these numbers. So what if I do A here is equal to B, and then times C? Well, if I represent that on the computer, it's going to be like this. And that would mean that I would have B here times 1 plus delta B, and then C times 1 plus delta C. And well, if I do this, then I can divide over and look at the relative error. And it's going to be B times C here over A. Well, then I'm going to get some cross terms here. But whatever is quadratic in the deltas, I'm just going to forget about that. So it'll be 1 plus delta B plus delta C. And a typical calculation, you might actually be doing a few hundred million multiplications and so forth. And that means that it becomes rather crucial that you can control what's going to be happening with these errors here. They will accumulate here. Let me just let's do a few examples here. Suppose I have a function here, which is the square root of x squared plus 1. But then, for whatever reason, I want to subtract 1 from it. So you can see that this is a typical example that what happens here if x is close to 0. Well, if x is close to 0, then we're going to get this problem here that we could suffer a severe cancellation. So what should we do here? Basically, what I'm telling you is that you should just look at your mathematical formulas, recognize things like this, and then say, oh, well, maybe I should think about what I'm doing and see if I couldn't just rewrite this. So how should we rewrite this? Basic math. Well, we multiply by 1. I think you're saying the 1. There are many solutions probably here. But I could write this as my this here plus 1 minus 1. And then I multiply here by this one plus 1 and then divide it by that. Right? So if I do this, then it actually turns out that an equivalent of formulation here is, of course, x squared and then divide it by this one plus 1. And the problem is that whenever you write a code, then you're so happy that you actually arrive at an analytical formula that you never think about that the formula, if you actually stick it on the computer, is going to have these cancellation errors, and you could trivially have removed quite a few of them. Here's another good one that I like. It involves math that I can understand, which is solving a second-order equation. How about this one? So if I have minus b and then plus minus b squared minus 4ac over 2a, right? And we look at the case where b squared here, it's going to be a lot bigger than 4ac, which if you ever solve second order equations, then that's going to come out to be not so uncommon, in fact. So what do we do here? solving a second order equation. Can you imagine the well, the solution here is that only one root will suffer subtraction error. Right? So depending on the sign of B, I can take the root that would correspond to either plus and minus here. And that's going to be safe, right? So I can calculate one of the roots. How do I get the other one then? Oh, come on, it's high school physics or high school math. If I know one root of the second order equation, how do I get the other one? What do you mean by factoring? It's probably the right answer, but. Yes, right? So you just use that x1 times x2, if these are the two roots here, is c over a. Right? And that's, this is, of course, much easier. So if you get one of the roots, then there's no reason to go in and do another square root and so forth. Yeah?
Actually, for this code angle, yeah, I want to use the sum that you will get the same problem.
Well, yeah, so you have to figure out, you have to figure out which root here is going to be easy to evaluate. So, okay. So, you know, you can just go through and there are many of these examples that you can come by. And you can see this requires so little effort just to locate these things and think a little bit about what it is that you're doing. You can actually, the errors that you will suffer if you come by these, if you have a subtractive errors that will accumulate like this, your result will be off by maybe 100%. And if you do a little rewrite like this, then you get 10 decimal digits. So it's all or nothing. So I have another little example here. It's summations. So again, I hope you can appreciate the fact that you may want to calculate a sum of something. So today you think for the tutorial, you're going to be looking at expressions for pi here and there, of course, a great many of them. But I could be looking at something like this one here. And the last time I checked, then this should be pi squared over 6. So pi squared here, of course, you all know now by heart that this is 1644934066848. How do you want to evaluate? So what is going to happen here is that we might want to write something where we set the sum equal to 0.0, and then I do for k equal to 1, and then maybe up to 4096, then I set the sum equal to sum, and then plus 1.0 over k times k. How does that look? Is there a problem with writing something like this? What would be the problem here? What? Yeah, that's another issue. It might be slowly converging. But is there something, what's going to happen if I put in 4097? Uh, Well, so let's think about this rather quickly. This sum here will probably be of the order 1.6, at least of the order 1. Then I'm adding a number here, which is 1 over k squared. And if you remember, then here I could be assuming that my real here, my sum was declared as a real. And then you can see that what I'm doing here is I'm taking a number which is of order 1, and then I'm adding 1 over k squared to it. So if you remember, there was something with machine epsilon, right? So when this number here becomes smaller than epsilon, what's going to happen? Nothing more will happen. Because any subsequent terms will just be dropped. So if you look at how you're converging, so I could look at the sum here and then minus pi squared over 6. And it's going to decrease like this. And then when I hit, so you can see that 4096, what's the power of 2 that this corresponds to? I think it should be 2 to the 12. So k squared here, when I'm at 4096, then that is actually going to be 2 to the minus 24. And if you remember, the last thing we could add to 1, that was 2 to the minus 23. And so it means that you're looking or trying to measure the error, and it's going to decrease, and it's going to flatline. And then you stare at it and says, oh, the computer is broken. Well, you know, I can't do anything about this. So how should we just do this?
Sum it backwards.
Yes, right. So if you do these sums and you know that it's going to be converging to something of the order 1, then you bump it up here, and then you say, well, maybe let's do 8096 or whatever it is. And if in Fortran you want to do it the other way around, then you start with the high number, take the low number, and then you specify in increments of minus 1. So if I do this, then I'm not going to have a problem with the machine epsilon, because the sum, when I'm doing this addition here, then the sum will also be a small number. And likely the 1 over k squared that I'll be adding will always be of the order of the sum itself, right? Particularly the last term that I'll be adding will be 1 over a quarter, so it'll be a quarter that I'll be adding to something probably of the order of 1, which sounds very reasonable. So in particularly if you're evaluating sums, then please do it backward. You know, it's not a huge effort just to switch around the do loops, and you might actually gain 8 more digits in your results here. So I'm not going to, I think, I'm not going to tell you more about these details, because the things that you'll come by, you know, I can't predict what they will be. I just want to alert you to the fact that with a little bit of effort, then you can actually improve your code dramatically. Yeah.
So we can not add numbers less than epsilon to 1 or greater numbers, but we can always add numbers smaller than epsilon to each other.
Well, epsilon here, and that was crucial, it was defined relative to 1. So it's the smallest number that I can add to 1 that will give me something that's non-zero. Right? So I can add 2 numbers that are order epsilon. That's not a problem, because I can just shift the exponent. So and the exponent here for a real, we saw that it could be between basically minus 37 to plus 37, 38. Right? But if one of the numbers is of order of 1, then I can't shift the exponent. I'm stuck, and I'm going to suffer this error. So it's perfectly valid to add. I can add numbers very efficiently, very fine, if they're the same order of magnitude. But if one of them is of order 1 and the other one is of order epsilon, then you've had it, right? Other questions? Yeah.
So if you take 1 plus epsilon and get 1 back, like if you start changing the 1 and keeping the epsilon fixed, at what point does the answer not become equals to 1? Like not 1, but you know what I mean?
Right. write a pre-buy program. So you should actually, you know, my claim here, and if you looked at the floating point representation, you can try to see if some of you have these small netbooks, and maybe they cheated with the floating point operations here. So you can try to check on the different systems here what the floating point systems look like. And you can try to figure out what the epsilon should be simply by doing something like this. I can just take k here and vary it, and then see when 1 over k squared becomes of the order of 2 to the minus 24, then you should get 1 back, right? By add to that. But that, you know, if they cheated with the floating point implementation, then maybe it's going to be happening before that. So you can think about it the other way around. If I take epsilon and then I start adding numbers to it when a thing's going to go wrong. So the best thing is I just want to alert you to these issues here. And with a little bit of effort here, then you can actually get code that, yes?
So you're often trying to evaluate a sum to like a certain, like you have a precision that you need, and you want to evaluate the sum to that precision. So,
well, that's another story, because your sum may in itself be very badly converging. And it could mean that to get any kind of reasonable precision on your result, you would need to evaluate not 8,000 terms, but a few hundred thousand. And that would be bad news.
But supposing when we were doing the homework, somebody mentioned that a good way to check when you have to stop is to just keep doing it until your answer is within it. Like, you know, keep summing up higher order terms until the answer is close enough. But if you do that, you can't sum backwards because.
Well, no, yeah, so there's a whole theory of how you want to sum a series, and there's a whole theory of how you want to estimate the error terms. And I'm not focused on that. And it has to do with, you can also try to estimate your sum by an integral, and that's called the Euler-Maclaurin formula. It's incredibly useful in a lot of mathematical physics, and I would just, you know, I'm not going to go there. Somebody else had a...
We're going to do that in the mathematical methods course.
Yes,
next week.
Yes. So any of these... so there's a whole beautiful theory, right, and you'll be hearing about that in a few weeks, right? That'll be after this course.
Yeah.
So you just take all the questions that you really want to ask me. Ask them. Okay. So I want to tell you some other little things here. Now, before that, see. It's almost Halloween, so I can read you another story. And this is Bruno down here, right? Yeah. So maybe you'll recollect some of this story here. So on June 4th, 1996, what happened? Well, no, it's a long shot, so I'm going to tell you, right? An unnamed... it's not an unnamed, an unmanned... I don't have my reading glasses here. An unmanned Ariane 5 rocket. So I distinctly remember this, right? Bruno doesn't. I do. It was launched by the European Space Agency, so the Ariane 5, or the Ariane rockets, are the biggest payload rockets that we have today for taking things into space. I believe that's right. So it's a complicated technology, and there's great pride associated with this. It was launched June 4th, 1996, and it exploded just 40 seconds after liftoff. Yeah, I just wanted to show that child prodigy is hired to do it. So here's the cat, right? The rocket was on its first voyage, right? So this was the first Ariane 5, I'm making this up, but I think that it was the first rocket, and it was supposed to show everybody in the whole world that the Ariane 5 was on track, and then of course it blew up. So the rocket was on its first voyage after a decade of development, costing $7 billion. The destroyed rocket and its cargo were valued at $500 million, right? So we're getting more and more expensive. A board of inquiry investigated the causes of the explosion, and in 2 weeks issued a report. It turned out that the cause of the failure was a software error in the inertial reference system. So get this. Specifically, a 60-bit floating point number relating to the horizontal velocity of the rocket with respect to the platform was converted to a 16-bit signed integer. I don't know why anybody would do that, but they did. So the number was larger than 32,768, the largest integer storable in a 16-bit signed integer, and thus the conversion failed. Just to show you that having some idea of what it means to have an integer and a real, it could save you $7 billion, right? So, what?
How did that actually cause the rocket to
explode? There's a whole story, and you can go, and I can give you the link, and you can read the entire report, both in English and French, by the inquiry board. I think the real question is why they found it necessary to take a 16-bit floating point number and convert it to a 16-bit signed integer. It's hard for me to imagine why that would be necessary, but anyway, that's what happened. Okay. So, what I'm going to tell you about now is a little bit about functions, because eventually you want to write a function. Simplest thing that I can think of is that suppose we have a polynomial. It turns out that if you do numerical analysis, then somehow we always end up converting everything to polynomials, so it's useful to have some idea of what they might or might not do here. So suppose I have a function here, which is a, and then cos cubed here, x, what did I come up with? Cos squared of x, and then plus c times cos of x here, and then plus d. How do we want to write a code for this? So let me just give you the answer. So first of all, you can see that I could be evaluating cosine many times. So first, evaluate cosine once, not n times, right? So we want to take a value or a variable and set cosine equal to it. But then more importantly, when we write y here, then we sort of write it as a nested series. So I do a times t, and then plus b, then probably I want to multiply this by t here. And then I want to add c to it. And then I add, or I multiply that by t. And then finally, I add d, right? So if you have polynomials, please always do something like this. Right, you can see that this is the trick. This is based on what I've been telling you, that these numbers, suppose cosine x here is 0.1. If I start taking that to a high power, then I get into these problems where I'm multiplying numbers that are large and small together and adding a constant of maybe of order 1. So if I decompose the polynomial, and this can always be done for a polynomial, right? Then please do something like this. It's not going to take you a lot of time, right? And it'll give you 10 more digits, and your rockets won't explode, right? Is anybody of you going to go into space science? Or if so, then I'll stay far away from the launch pad. No, of course you won't. I don't mean to imply, by the way, that all rockets that exploded were due to programming errors. But
just
some of them, right? So do this, right? You're always going to be writing a polynomial somewhere, and do this. A very famous polynomial that for some reason people don't tend to think about as a polynomial, that's called a Taylor series, right? So I would have f of x here, and I can sort of vaguely remember that I can write it as f of x0 here, and then plus a sum here of n plus 1 to infinity, then h to the power n factorial. And then I evaluate the derivative in x0. How does that look? Right? So this is a polynomial, OK? For implementation, maybe you want to call it something else. But for implementation purposes, then, and of course, h here is equal to this. So it's a polynomial in this little variable. And by now, you should know that evaluating a factorial by, so what you don't want to do, right, is evaluating the factorial, which is going to be a humongous number, and then divide that up into h to the power n, which is going to be an incredibly small, right? So what you should do?
So, the obvious thing is simple.
Yes,
is this. But will you please do this, right? So it's not completely clear to me. Like, what you wanted, if you actually wanted to do it term by term, you would sum it backwards. But is, like, when you do it this way, you feel like you're summing it forwards. But do you get the same problems as when you're summing it forward?
No, you start here and then work here. Which would sort of be backwards, right? But you know, I'm not going to force anything on top of you. I just want to alert you to a lot of issues that I want you to think about. And there are many solutions. There are many things you could do. I just don't want to have you do the stupid things. And so this is one of the homework. You're going to be doing a Taylor series, and pose problems like this, and about 50% of the students, they will always go in, they'll write a function here which will evaluate the factorial. And if you write a factorial, you can, the factorial is a pretty big number. Just the factorial of 20, it's going to overflow. And but of course, if I multiplied it by the very small number to a very high power, then I would get something that's finite. Right? So please think about these issues. The other thing here is that you could say, okay, so I have a function that I want to evaluate, and by hard labor, then I actually managed to develop a Taylor series for it. So the I don't want to call that a problem, but maybe this is a feature. There is a radius of convergence. So if you have a Taylor series, then you know that there's going to be a radius of convergence associated with it. And if you go outside of that radius of convergence, then your Taylor series is not going to be working anymore. And again, if you ask your, who's going to be doing the mathematical physics course?
Carl Bender.
Yeah, Carl Bender. He has this wonderful book, Bender and Ortsak, which you're probably going to be using. You know, if you do analytical continuation of your function, then my hand-waving way of estimating the radius of convergence is just starting from the point where I want to develop and then go out to the nearest pole. And that would be the maximum radius of convergence that you could ever get. So there's a whole, you know, you can play games here. Whenever you're using a series like this, then you should be aware of the fact that you're having a radius of convergence that's going to come into play at some point. Then the other thing here is, I think I mentioned this already, this here is a polynomial. So it's going to be hard to get it to diverge. And it turns out that in a lot of cases, you can actually already figure out that the function you're trying to evaluate, it might have a pole, so or a square root divergence or something like this somewhere on the axis. And then yet you're still trying to do a Taylor series for it. But basically, a Taylor series here, it's a nice polynomial for all practical purposes. I can't really get it to diverge. So it might work wonderfully well, but if you're approaching some kind of a divergence of your function, you know that's always going to be, let's say less good, right? So we can't really get this to diverge. Let me tell you about other sort of neat things that you can do here I want to tell you about Newton's method for finding roots. And there'll be some comment as to why we could use that for writing a function, right? So whenever I draw a function here, then it's always very nicely behaved. Your actual function, of course, is not going to behave like this. But when you teach a course, all your functions are nice. It looks something like this. And I want to find this point here. So I have f of x and also its derivative available, right? So some kind of closed analytical form. And maybe I know here that at this point that we call xn, I can then evaluate f of x and its derivative. And I want to find out what this point here is. So what I can do here is I can try to estimate this point, which we call xn plus 1, and then do exactly the same thing here. Take the derivative and figure out where that is going to hit the zero axis. So in order to figure out what if x of n plus 1 here is, then we approximate the, we say here that f of x plus delta, it's going to be what we have in the point x of n here, and then its derivative, and then times delta, where delta, of course, is xn plus 1 minus x. And then I throw out whatever is there. And then I set this equal to 0, right? So if that is equal to 0 here, then this here has to be equal to 0. And then that means that I can figure out what xn plus 1 is here. So it's my previous value and then the function here divided by its derivative. And that's it's an incredibly useful method. And it actually converges quadratically. So it is very fast convergence. You can obviously see what would go wrong here. Well, first of all, you may not know this, so that would be bad news. The other thing that could go wrong is that if your function is sort of bending and you don't get close enough to the actual root, but you start over here, then you can probably guess what's going to be going on, right? Very interestingly, then I can use this for finding, I can use this for writing a function by using Newton's method. So how would I do this? Well, suppose that f of x here is equal to x squared minus a, for instance, then what's the roots here? Wake up, everybody. The roots here, the last time I checked, that would be this, right? So amazingly, then it means that I go over here and then I read that xn plus 1, it should be equal to xn, and then minus my function, which should be xn squared minus a. But then I need to take the derivative, and that's just going to be 2xn. And this I can rewrite. And this is 1 half xn plus a over xn. And then I can iterate this. And that actually will converge, given the fact that you are starting close enough to the root. In this case, it's not going to be a problem, because this is going to be a nice parabola, right? So it'll just, your function won't bend. So in this case, you can actually start anywhere you like. So you should compare this to a Taylor series and see what you like the best. I don't know everything there is to know about the history of algorithms, but the claim is that this was known by the Babylonians about 4,000 years ago. And they knew how to do this trick. You sort of wonder how they would know, because they probably couldn't do calculus. But it shows these underlying ideas here. The other sort of obvious thing here, if you do something like this, there's no radius of convergence. So, and more importantly, I need this one. And in some cases, I don't have that. I want to tell you two more things here. I have a whole book that's called The History of Algorithms here. And it's sort of incredible what people knew and then forgot and then rediscovered and forgot again. This here can be generalized. So I should also say that this is called Newton's method, but you should, it should really be called the Newton-Raphson method. And so Raphson here was a contemporary of Newton's, and he discovered it independently, and then Newton showed that he also had discovered this. So it can be generalized to higher dimensions. And it's a very useful technique. And very, very often, you're going to see that the problem that you want to solve, it can be reduced to finding the root of or the zero of some equation. And the generalization of this equation here is basically that we have a set of equations that I'm gonna put a vector on this, and they depend on n variables here. And then you can see that I would have the term here, and then my little step here. And you can probably guess that what is going to take the place here of the derivative is now going to be the Jacobian. And then I would add my delta x, which is now going to be a vector. So this here is, of course, a matrix. And then I can solve this, and I set that equal to 0, and it's going to give me my step here. But the underlying idea here is entirely the same. I just want to say that if you're looking at these methods and if you want to find a root, then you may not know this derivative. And then the default method here that you can always use is called bisection. Particularly, you may be doing this for some of your programs. So the idea here is very simple. You take your function, and then you bracket a 0. If it happens that your function actually will do something like this, so you'll have several roots in your interval, then it's just going to pick out one of them. But it's going to be difficult to tell which one you'll get. But you will get one root. And let's just assume that the function doesn't do anything funky here. It'll just behave nicely like this. So what we can do, okay, I guess I don't have any more space to write. So what we can do here is that when we start this, we bracket the root. So we assume that we know that there is a root in the interval a to b. So that would mean that our function in a and in b, if I multiply them together, this has to be less than 0, right? So what you do now is that I choose c here, which is the midpoint. So I divide the interval equal to 2, and that's called c here, right? And then I just look at the value of fa here times fc. This here is less than 0, then it means that C here, it actually had to be over here, right? So if this is the case, then what I do, I just set B equal to C. If that's not the case, then the point C must have been on the other side of the root. So I set A equal to C. And then I end my statement, right? And then I just iterate a couple of times. And each time, you can see that I'm cutting my interval in half. So you're going to be converging And you're going to end up with an interval which is going to be incredibly small, and the size will be cut in half every time. So this actually will find the root quite nicely. It's going to, well, you can compare it here to Newton. It's fail-safe, and given the fact that you can bracket the minimum. So the last thing I want to tell you about is, well, so we saw that I could develop a Taylor series, and we saw here that I could, be fancy and develop a little recursion relation. I sort of like this because, have you thought about writing a square root like this before? Maybe not. Maybe you do this. So the last thing you can do, and which is may seem like a little bit of a curiosity, but actually turns out that it's not. Kind of like telling you about it because it relates to other things here. So I can try to do what's called a continued fraction. Right? So in particularly, maybe I want to evaluate the square root of 2. So what I do is that I write it as 1 plus, and then I do the square root of 2 minus 1. You with me so far? And then I do sort of exactly what we did at the beginning of the class. I say, well, maybe I want to write this as 1 plus the square root of 2 minus 1, and then divided by the square root of 2 plus 1, and then multiplied by this. Okay. So if I can calculate this correctly, then it would be 2 minus 1. And 2 minus 1 here, it would be 1 over then, well, what I have here, which is square root 2 plus 1. and I'm going to write it as 2 plus the square root of 2 minus 1. And then you can probably see where this is going, because I have this up here, and I can just repeat the calculation. So this here would be 1 plus 1 over 2 plus 1 over 2 plus 1 over 2 plus 1 over 2. And we have what's called a continued fraction. Continued fractions are actually useful in different settings. So here's another good question for Bender. What's the radius of convergence of this thing? I would claim here that, again here, there's no radius of convergence. I think, but I, you know, I'm not, my specialty is not mathematical physics, but I think it's a known fact that this is going to oscillate around the limit. If you're looking at your error here, it's going to look something like this. So it'll be staggering up and down. And you can think about why that would be the case and whatnot. But more importantly, we could think about how we would write a function that would do this and what that might mean. So I do many body physics, and it turns out that you can actually develop what's called continued fraction expansions and so forth. So it's not entirely without merit. So we could think about how to evaluate this. And this year, you can see this is sort of it's a bit nasty looking. Suppose that I have a function here that I've managed to develop this series for. So it would be b0, and then maybe I would have some a1 here. Then I would have b1, and then I would have an a2, then b2 here, plus, well, a3 over b3, and so forth. How are we supposed to evaluate this? Well, what we do is that we truncate, right? So I could say that f of x here, maybe it's equal to b0 and then plus a1, b1 plus a2 over b2 here. And then you sort of play around with this and just put it all on one. Write it as one fraction here, and then, okay, so it's actually a2b0 here, and then plus a1b2, and then over b1b2 plus a2. And this I can write as something that looks like a polynomial, and then divide it by a polynomial. So actually, what you see here is that the fact that I took my continued fraction and then I truncated it, I obtained something that we call a rational polynomial. Does anybody know where we see a lot of rational polynomials? What? I don't know anything about that. If you pull out your Bender, Carl Bender and Orszag book, where would there be? Well, there's something that's called Pate approximants. So a Pate approximant is a special rational polynomial where you match the coefficients in your rational polynomial to the power series. It's very useful because by magic, it's good for extrapolation. So corollary, if anybody actually ask you to extrapolate a function beyond the limits where you know it, then get another job. Extrapolating a function is voodoo, in my opinion. It always works in the example in the book, but for your function, it never works. But I just want to point out that there's a what we've done here. So I started by showing you a polynomial, and I said we could write a Taylor expansion. We could think about that as a polynomial. This year, I would claim that truncating, I get a ratio of two polynomials. And of course, the trick is that I can get that to diverge. So if there's any kind of funky behavior where the function shoots up or shoots down, then this year might be a lot better. So the last thing I want to tell you about here is you could say to yourself, well, how would I write a program that would evaluate a continued fraction? And what I'm going to show you is a recursion formula for it. And then I'm just going to tell you that the recursion formula will reproduce this. Right? So our goal is to evaluate this. And what we do here is that I say what I call a minus 1. So it'll be one of these big polynomials that at the end we'll take a ratio of these two here. This is going to be equal to 1. Then I take big B minus 1 and I set it equal to 0. And then I say a0 here is going to be equal to little b0, where that's this coefficient. And then I say that big b0 is equal to 1. And then I can get the big a for higher values of the index j here, I get it by taking little bj here, multiplying by aj minus 1, and then plus aj multiplied by big aj minus 2. And bj here, it's equal to little bj, big bj minus 1, and then plus little aj, bj minus 2. Okay, so what that means is that I can start with these four, we could call them polynomials, they're just constants, largely, maybe not this one. And then I can sort of evaluate the continuing fractions forward, because I can just iterate up until I get an and bn to the desired order. And that's kind of neat, because suppose that your truncation after a given step didn't give you the precision that you wanted, and maybe you want to add on a few more terms, then it's trivial to do it with this recursion relation, but it's going to be hard if you actually evaluated this continued fraction bottom up or whatever you were trying to do. If I go in here and then I look at what I had, a2 over b2 over here, then at least I can check what we have here. So a2, well, it should be equal to b2 times a1 plus a2 times a0. And if we substitute in what a1 is, then that should be b1 times b0. And then I need then also to add a1. And then I get plus a2 here. And then I need a0, but that's written here. So this is b0. And then I needed big b2 here. Well, it's going to be little b2 times big B1, and well, I can just go up and read here. So it'll be A2 and then times B0. If we just insert what that's going to be, then it'll be B2, B1, and then plus A2. And lo and behold, if I put a bar here, then yes, it's a2, b0, then that expression should be equal to that expression. And then by proof, by empirical check, that if it works for n equal to 2, then I don't know. It's probably right for any n. So I claim that these recursion relations, that, I don't know, I'm going to play around with them more than you can, but just check, trust me, that it actually works. So this is how you would evaluate one of these continued fractions. And now this guy fell totally asleep. So let's stop here.